You've heard about me already. I am the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of COPD, which also makes me a little bit nervous. Perhaps I've turned down some of your articles. I am very sorry if I've done that. When we have COPD, we have an idea of what we want to achieve. We want a better diagnosis. We want to stop people smoking, absolutely, for primary prevention. We want better symptom control, fewer exacerbations, slow progression, better life expectancy. That's what patients want. We want very similar things. Again, symptom control, prevent exacerbations. We are very lined up with what patients want. And I think we should remember that because it's somewhat different to asthma. And I hope you'll come to hear me speak out about asthma later on, where I will bring about some of these differences. We now have the GOLD guidance. This is very, very important. I also think it is going to change a little bit in the next few years because as we become more sophisticated with our phenotyping and understanding of COPD. And you've already heard in this conference, Professor Price, Professor Vedzica, talking about how we are getting cleverer and smarter about understanding airways disease and phenotyping, and that's very much one of my interests. But it also means, very importantly, that depending upon how we phenotype our patients, we need to give them different treatments. In the world, we cannot afford all of our treatments, and we should give the right treatment to the right patient. And that is absolutely critical now, for lots and lots of reasons, which I'll explain to you in a moment. I'm going to focus on exacerbations a bit. You've heard a lot about exacerbations in the breakfast meeting and in the symposium that Professor Vedzica ran. Exacerbations are really, really important. Patients with COPD have symptoms. We can make some of those better, but they have symptoms. But they have these attacks, these exacerbations, which we do not fully understand. Some are caused by pollution. Some are caused by viruses. Some occur almost spontaneously. What happens? One of my patients tells me he normally can walk 100 meters, and he does okay. But when an attack happens, his chest closes down, he can only walk 5 meters and can't even get to the toilet. What is going on? There's worsening of symptoms. It affects their daily life. It affects health status and leads to time in hospital, and that's a problem. This is some very interesting research done by David Halpin, a friend of mine from Exeter in Devon. And David looked at comorbidities associated with exacerbation and what happens after exacerbations. You know, even if you survive your exacerbation, you will still have a very significant increased chance of having heart failure, ischemic heart disease, atrial fibrillation, myocardial infarction, all go up in a very significant percentage of people. It's a real challenge. Now, if we look at the TORCH data, the TORCH study was a fantastic study, 3-year study looking at mortality. And one of the most important points about this study was they looked very closely at why people die. Remember, they were looking at all-cause mortality. So why do people die with COPD? Well, 35% die of COPD or die of respiratory cause, but many, many others die of other problems, particularly cardiac disease and cancer. I think that makes us, as a respiratory community, have to think, do we need to look at our patients in a whole way, not just from a COPD, but also from a cardiac perspective too. This is some British data. We look at our COPD admissions nationally every other year. So we know very closely what happens to our COPD patients, looking particularly at mortality rates. Now, I don't know what happens in Beirut and in the Lebanon, or in your countries perhaps, but I know that if I was in Britain and I had a heart attack, I mean, I fell down, I was dead, my heart was fibrillating, I had a full thickness, Q-wave, ST elevation, myocardial infarction, my mortality rate would be around 6.5% in UK. This is not chest pain, this is not troponin rise, this is the full myocardial infarction. In the UK right now, 14% of people admitted to hospital are dead with COPD within 90 days. Much, much worse than myocardial infarction. And yet, we think exacerbations of COPD can be very mild. I'm sure your junior doctors, your young doctors admitting patients think, oh, another COPD patient. They die, and we need to make sure that people understand this, that actually can actually respond appropriately to this. It would be on the news, but it's not on the news. COPD is very difficult to get on the news. So what have we got at the moment? We have bronchodilators. Kind of effective, often short-term, not as good as we'd like. We have steroids, and we'll talk about that a bit in a moment, of efficacy in some patients, probably not useful in others. And we have other therapies now coming through with LABA-LAMA combinations, and the respiratory world is very exciting at the moment. It's getting very, very busy. What goes on in COPD physiologically? Well, when we breathe normally, we have small airways, we breathe in and we breathe out. The airways open and close. The attachments hold them open, stop them collapsing when we breathe out. In COPD, those attachments are destroyed. One of the pieces of work I did in my PhD was to look at elastin in the lung. Elastin is conserved in your body. You cannot make it. So when it's gone, when elastases have eaten elastin, it's finished. And that's what happens in COPD, such that the airways close when people breathe out. You know this. There's some inflammation which causes this particular problem. This causes hyperinflation, increased residual volume, an inability to breathe. And I love teaching my patients and my young doctors what it's like to have COPD. The fact that you're breathing here, which is hard and uncomfortable and difficult to do, let alone talk. This leads to problems. How can you exercise when you've got gas trapping? You can't. And we have bronchodilators, which are there now, long-acting bronchodilators, tiotropium, glycopyrronium, aclidinium, salmeterol, formoterol, indicatrol, long-acting beta agonists, to help us with this gas trapping. A very, very nice study done by Professor Verzica was the INSPIRE study, which looked at whether tiotropium could be compared with our brand-leading fluticasone salmeterol combination product. And there was no significant difference in exacerbation rate in the study that looked at these people with moderate to severe COPD. What is really interesting is that these two drugs account for 75% of the world sales of COPD. And I would certainly say that perhaps we need to be re-estimating how we should be prescribing these drugs and particularly using the combination products. I'm going to touch very briefly with one slide on ACOS. You've already had a whole thing about ACOS, and I would recommend, if you get the chance, to read the Gina Gold Unified Statement on what ACOS is and perhaps what it isn't, because I don't think we really know what ACOS is at the moment. Asthma, eosinophilic, mast cell disease, CD4 positive cells with airways hyperresponsiveness, it is by its very nature steroid responsive, and that's a really important test to remember not to forget. In COPD, often neutrophilic driven, maybe driven by infection with very predominant and active macrophages. T cells involved are CD8 cells, not CD4 cells. There's no increase in atrophy, and they are not steroid responsive in general. And then there are other patients in the middle, and they maybe make up 10 to 20% of our patients, but we don't really know exactly who or what they are. If we look at responses to steroids and how things go, Sammy Sweetser, who is probably the best respiratory statistician in the world, he's an epidemiologist from Canada, and if you ever get a chance to listen to Sammy, go and listen to him. He is incredible. Sammy did a fantastic, has done lots of studies now looking at analyses of these big studies and found that actually if you look at the effects in the TORCH study of fluticasone versus salmeterol, the long-acting beta agonist, there was no benefit of the steroid. All the benefit was provided by the long-acting beta agonist. What about steroids? Should we be careful with steroids? Yes, we should. We use very high doses. The Isolde study, the Eurostop study, used big doses of fluticasone and of budesonide. We are using them in an elderly population with a high risk of osteoporosis, fractures, they have poor mobility, they have poor nutrition, they smoke, they have high problems here. There is an increased risk of cataracts in the higher risk as well. And I've certainly seen that on occasion. And there are other comorbidities. Don't play down the skin bruising, because many of my patients have very difficult skin bruising, and that's important. And I'm going to talk about pneumonia in a bit more detail. The TORCH study also was one of the first and the biggest that gave us a signal in pneumonia. There was a clear increase in people who use the fluticasone, whether it's in combination with the long-acting beta agonist or on its own, of pneumonia. A 6% absolute increase. This is a problem, and this was thought to be very considerable. Sammy Sweetser again did a study in thorax where he looked at this, and the number needed to treat to prevent an exacerbation in this study, which was a fantastically large all-comer study, remember, not specific study, an all-comer study, was 44. But there was, you only needed to treat 16 people to induce one pneumonia. It makes us think, and this is what's now going on. We know that it's related to steroids. We know the relative increase is 69%, and it's with the stronger steroids. So the stronger the steroids, the more effect there is on pneumonia. That's been confirmed in other studies now, including the PATHOS study, which was a very large database-driven study in Sweden, which showed, again, an excess mortality and excess incidence of pneumonia with fluticasone versus budesonide. So the signal is certainly there. So that's where we are with steroids. How are we actually using our steroids? The answer would be badly, very badly. If you think about back to the GOLD guidance, A, B, C, and D, we should potentially be using steroids in our group Ds and in some of our group Cs, but we probably should not be using them at all in group A and probably not in group B either. If you look at how we are using them, probably nearly 50% of patients in all categories, doesn't matter whether A, B, C or D, get the inhaled steroids, probably many of them without any need for them whatsoever. So what's wrong with that? They don't need them. There's excess side effects. We are wasting an enormous amount of money. In the UK, Seretide Accuhaler costs $75 a month. In the United States, a Seretide Accuhaler costs nearly $500 a month, which makes you realise how many of these, how big profits can be. We're also thinking we need to give people drugs, when in actual some ways we need to be concentrating on smoking cessation, pulmonary rehabilitation, deal with some of their comorbidities, other things that we need to be doing to actually improve the patient's lives as well as get really hard outcomes in COPD. What about bronchodilatation? Bronchodilators work. There's no question about it at all. They are very effective for symptoms, they improve quality of life, and they have a significant effect on exacerbations. I'll unpack that a little bit in a moment. How do they work? This is obvious. They're cholinergic antagonists such as Spiriva, Emeclidinium, a long-acting muscarinic antagonist, and adrenergic agonists, Olodaterol, Salmeterol, Formoterol, etc. They work in different and complementary ways. Not quite additive, but they work together in a very effective way. We explain it in one way to unlock the lungs, another way to open the lungs up. That's very, very important. Is this new? Is it a secret? No, it's not. We've known about this for a very long time. This was a recent study. I mean, I say recent from this way, it's 1999, but the other studies were in 1980s, which looked at what happens when you give short-acting treatments together when people with COPD. Well, actually, short-acting treatments work, whether it's albuterol in this case, and ipratropium, but you combine them together, you get a very effective response. Our patients have been telling us this. What is our patient's favourite drug for PRN usage? In the UK, it used to be Combivent, the combination of the two together. We don't have that anymore, but actually, it's a very, very good drug. Other studies, this is a Van Noord study in 2010, which looked at putting together the first long-acting muscarinic, tiotropium, with the first long-acting beta-agonist, salmeterol. Not the best beta-agonist in the world, but not a bad one. And when you looked at it once daily or twice daily, patients felt better. Their breathlessness was relieved. Just focus on the second one for a moment, the reliever medication use. We as doctors sometimes don't think reliever medication is important. We think, one puff, two puffs of salbutamol, no big deal. I would challenge you. I would ask you to think. If a patient is needing to take a puff of salbutamol, they are having symptoms. Turn it round. If they are not needing a puff of salbutamol, it means they are better and they are not having symptoms. And I think that's a really significant way of thinking and looking at this data. So it is important, even if it's a small effect, it shows they are feeling better. We now have combinations coming out. So we have four coming on the market now. Let's look at tiotropium as a partner for olodaterol. Why would we give tiotropium specifically to our patients? Well, we know that there is a huge heritage. I'm part of a group trying to decide which drugs we should be using. And one thing we cannot ignore is the absolutely enormous heritage that tiotropium has with improved lung function, massive symptomatic benefits, and studies such as the UPLIFT study and the POET study, which are some of the biggest studies done, and obviously also TEOSPHERE, which is the biggest study ever done in COPD. We know that they improve lung function, symptoms, and maintain lung function benefits for 4 years. We know, and from POET COPD, there's a reduction in exacerbation. This was against salmeterol, and improves exercise tolerance. And one of the most important things for myself as a practicing doctor is, do I understand, do I believe this data? Does it feel right to me? Yes, it does. Because they're not claiming that these are massive responses. They're claiming significant responses which make sense to our patients. These studies were all done on the top of their additional therapy on the top of ordinary therapy. These people were still taking their standard treatments. So this is very, very good, very solid, real-life data. We know that quality of life's improved. The Typhon study, which was published in a very important and very, very cleverly edited journal by myself, showed very clearly that quality of life was significantly improved. Now, this 4-point change in St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire is not a small change. A change of 4 points means that you are now leaving your house, doing your shopping, doing your housework, which is really, really significant. It's not a small thing whatsoever. And we know that these drugs work on that. We know in these big studies that these drugs have a major effect, and they also have an effect on exacerbations. And this has been picked up by the FDA, so they have, it's the only bronchodilator on its own to have an exacerbation-modifying role in its US label, which is not an easy thing to get. In the Bateman study that was published in 2010, there was a 31% risk reduction in exacerbation rate. In the UPLIFT study, there was a 14% reduction in the exacerbation rate, and that's on top of ordinary treatment with steroids and with long-acting beta agonists. So they are significant in what they do. Very important in the United Kingdom and in Europe, and I'm sure here as well, we have to be showing a reduction in hospitalization. Why? Hospitalizations kill people. Hospitalizations use resources. Hospitalizations cost a lot of money. And if we're going to give medication, which are not free, they are not cheap, we need to be showing a clear benefit. And again, the UPLIFT study showed very nicely a 14% reduction in risk of hospitalization. So this is a very positive thing we can sell. Are all LAMAs the same? Are you a Pepsi person or a Coke person? Which do we think is the best? Now, of course, that's a simple flavor thing, and it's got nothing to do with effect. They all have the same effect on rotting your teeth and making you fat. But, you know, are they all the same? Well, they're not. If you look at how they associate and dissociate from the M3 receptor, which is the receptor we really need to be hitting, actually, tiotropium has the longest half-life, again, leading to a once-daily dosing. Umeclidinium is similar, again, has a once-daily dosing. Aclidinium and glycopyrronium have a twice-daily dosing, which is somewhat different. If you look at the SPARK study, again, Professor Vazika did this study, a very nice study looking at exacerbations. She quite clearly demonstrated that when looking at mild exacerbations, there was a significant difference between tiotropium, glycopyrronium, and umeclidinium, with tiotropium being the most effective. Interesting, some of that signal was lost when it becomes severe exacerbation. I want to just think about this for a moment. Forget the addition, forget putting it all together, exacerbations. Let's break this down and let's think, is there a difference here between the mild exacerbations and the severe exacerbations? I think we are beginning to get more sophisticated with phenotyping to say, you know, yes, there is. There is a significant difference between those exacerbations which the patients report on diary cards, which the patients report by increasing beta agonist use, with those exacerbations which end up in hospital admissions. which are obviously more severe and have more implications and obviously have the mortality associated with them. And I believe that there is data out there we can unpack and studies to be done which will break down those exacerbations and make us become much more sophisticated about how we use our medications and how we target the different types of exacerbations. You've heard already about eosinophilic exacerbations, and they're very, very important because they are very steroid responsive. Whereas it's likely that people who do not have eosinophilic disease do not respond to steroids at all. And that's a very important point as well. Just to summarize from that study, there was, a clear reduction in the number of exacerbations that were had versus tiotropium, so that they do something. Let's move on to the beta agonist. What about olodaterol? This may be a relatively new compound to us. It's a long-acting beta agonist. It's a once-daily long-acting beta agonist. It has been proven and discovered and developed specifically by Boehringer for COPD. This, again, is another very important point. Many of our drugs, when we started, were steroids, which came from asthma. They were invented and they were developed. Beclomethasone was the very, very first designer drug. But we had them and we decided we had nothing else. We had to use them in COPD. With tiotropium and with olodaterol, the medications have been specifically designed for COPD. It's a long-lasting effect. It's a fast-acting effect. It works for 24 hours. It improves lung function. And it seems to match very nicely with tiotropium. If you look at FEV1 response, the curves are identical, again implying that they should work very, very nicely together. This is a very busy study, and all I want you to take out of it really is the fact that the studies being done, the development of studies and development of the evidence for olodaterol is very, very thorough, showing long-term studies with two doses, because they were looking for dose-ranging studies as well, but against placebo, against formoterol, as a very good quick-acting, long-acting bronchodilator, and obviously against tiotropium itself. Let's look at some of the data. There's no question at all that when we look at FEV1, peak FEV1 and trough FEV1, there is a significant bronchodilator response with olodaterol. It's reassuring, it's stable, it doesn't change whether between 12 weeks and 24 weeks. If you look at SGRQ, so St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire, designed by Paul Jones, olodaterol but not formoterol demonstrates the higher responder rate. Now, what is a responder rate? Again, think about your patients. This data suggests that just over 10% of people who receive olodaterol versus formoterol will get that 4-point response in SGRQ. That 4-point response, as I've said, is very significant and is a big response. So 10% more of our patients getting a big response has got to be a good thing. So responder rate analysis, I think, is a very powerful thing to think about. It shows us more of the people are getting more of the benefit for more of the time. Big studies have been done with olodaterol, showing that olodaterol 5 micrograms significantly improves lung function, which is what's required by the FDA and the European standards authorities for licensing. There's improvement in lung function, comparable with long-acting muscarinic antagonists, and also with formoterol. And it translated into symptomatic benefit. The patients felt better on TDI and on SGRQ. So there was a big, thorough program of developments showing this drug does what we think it should do. Okay, so the future. What is going to happen next? And I think it would be very interesting to have a debate about where this is going to go, but let's look at some of the data. Putting the two drugs together, it seems like an obvious thing to do, but we have been very cautious about doing this kind of thing. We have tiotropium monotherapy, which has been around for 13 years, established therapy for COPD with benefits, as I've said, in lung function, symptoms, exacerbations, exercise tolerance, and now we have olodaterol. It seems they should go together very, very nicely to see further benefits of those things. So does that deliver what we said it did? Fortunately, the answer is yes, based on lung function. So there is a significant improvement in lung function versus tiotropium or olodaterol alone, with a significant uplift in FEV1, both as a peak FEV1 and as a trough FEV1. There's an enormous, enormous clinical trial program going ahead, with some of these studies now reporting. Tornado, I'll speak about in a moment. Vivacito is now being reported, right the way through to the Otempto study, which is going to be the really big one. This is a one-year study looking at hospitalizations and exacerbations. Does this really work and do good and improve things for us? Does lung function improve after six-week treatment in the Vivacito study? This is a physiological study. The answer is yes, it does, with a significant change, which was consistent throughout the study. FEV1 response is about 240 mL versus placebo, about 90 mL of trough versus single agents alone. It's about what we're seeing with many of these medications. In another study, again, showing very, very similar responses, this is the second study showing FEV1 response of about the same figures, 80 mL. I want to just unpack this slide for a moment. This is relatively new data, which was as an abstract at the American Thoracic Society a couple of weeks ago. This is very exciting. Dennis O'Donnell and the Canadian people are extremely good at doing work on physiology and physiological outcomes, and Dennis has done this work looking at full lung function with the new TNO combination. And if you look at the second graph over, the last two graphs over on the right-hand side, there is a 700 mil reduction in residual volume, 700 mils, with a 500 mil reduction in functional residual capacity. This, for our patients who've got an FEV1 of around 1.5 liters, is a very significant ability to breathe, a very significant room to breathe. And I think if this translates into functional benefit, and that's what we're yet to see, there's some improvements in lung function and functional benefit, it will be very, very exciting indeed for our patients. We know tiotropium particularly is very good at this. The Tornado study was a study looking at tiotropium, olodaterol for 1 year, looking at FEV1 on our endpoints with St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire as well, showed again a very similar FEV1 response. With a trough FEV1 response, again, around 70 mils above the individual data. SGRQ was significantly improved by the combination product below the four-point change, which was very, very significant and also very pleasing to see. There was no placebo arm here because it would not be appropriate to have a placebo arm in this study with patients long-term. But what about exacerbations? Well, actually, when you looked at this data, this was published in the European Respiratory Journal about 2 months or 3 months ago now by Roland Buhl. And Roland looked at this, and actually, there was a very clear signal of reduced exacerbation with the combination product versus the mono components. So long term, we are going to be doing our patients some good. So I ask you this question. Why are we not giving bronchodilators is the first choice in COPD? Why have we been giving steroids to many of our patients who don't need them? Are we still scared that our patients have got asthma? I don't know. We shouldn't be scared of that. We're respiratory specialists. Are we worried that we won't be completely treating our patients or that we won't have anything in our back pockets in case we have to extend therapy further? Again, I would argue we may well be denying our patients something of a further benefit. But we are generally conservative. I think going forward, as we get cleverer with phenotyping, with understanding our patients, we'll be able to say, you're group B, you're group D. You get steroids, you don't get steroids. You get maximum bronchodilatation, you get everything, to get the best benefit from our patient in the most cost-effective manner. The future of this has to be research. We have to be developing further bronchodilators, which are better. There still is a little bit of room for improvement when you try and maximize bronchodilatation. We need novel anti-inflammatory agents, and there's a lot of work being done now in biologic therapies for COPD, which potentially is very exciting. And we really do need better side effect profiles, because one of the biggest problems for our patients are side effects, whether that's a dry mouth, whether that's a tachycardia, whether that's skin bruising or cataract formation. It's a problem. I'm going to talk very briefly now about inhaler devices. The Respimat Soft Mist Inhaler is a unique device. It's an extremely efficient device. You can tell it's efficient because they had to put just 5 micrograms of tiotropium in versus the 18 micrograms in the hand inhaler to get exactly the same effect. It doesn't require a propellant. It has a very clever soft mist technology, which allows a trigger, a spring trigger, to then cause a pressure change, disaggregating the particles, which the patient breathes in slowly and gently, in a similar way to an MVI, but with much less of an effect of a trigger. There's extremely good deposition in the lung, and but it does need that little bit of coordination. Oh, that's not good. Maybe a restart. It's good I haven't got control, because I probably would lose control at this stage. So I'm just relying on my colleagues over there. Almost there.
It's a benefit of reviewing your talk all at once.
I can start again. I can do it better next time. Excellent. Okay. So I think the other thing about this is, which is really exciting, is its design. We are, as a society, we are, as a world, really interesting design at the moment. Who's got the most up-to-date iPhone? Who's got the most up-to-date LG phone or Samsung phone? You know, we are interested in technology. And I think the respirator is a very well-designed, very clever item of design, which patients can feel. And when patients pick it up, they know it's a solid piece of device. Let's look at a video. This is important, showing how respirator's delivered. When you press an MDI, the flow of material out of the MDI is very, very fast versus the respirator, which is slower. Patients can't use MDIs. I hate MDIs. We should never give people MDIs without a spacer. The respirator gets round many of those problems with a very slow mist. That was slowed down a little bit, but is very slow. The slow inhalation leads to an enormous benefit in deposition, which we can see here. So it's a good device that does what it says. What do patients want? Patients want to know their drug works. They want to feel it working. They want it to be easy to use. They don't want to be charging every time. They want a multi-dose inhaler. They want to know how many they've got left. They are more aware of the impact on society and on the environment, and that's important too. We as doctors and we as our colleagues in nursing and pharmacy, who've got to teach people, need to have placebos for teaching. It's absolutely essential. And we need them to be easily used by people with low inspiratory flow rates. Now, this graph here is one that you've seen already in this conference. It's a study that Dave Singh from Manchester did, looking at flow rates. And it is important, but it does not tell you the whole picture. Patients actually generate flow rates which are very low. Most of our patients can generate flow rates below 20, can easily generate a 20 liters per minute flow rate. And so I'd say this is a little bit disingenuous, because it goes far too far, far more real, far very extreme for none of our patients can reach. But the other thing I have a problem with flow rate is that flow rate is not everything. Just because I can go and I can generate a high flow rate does not mean I then get the drug, because I've got to have the volume to breathe it in. And realistically, how many of our COPD patients have got a volume as well as a flow rate? It is very difficult for patients to do. So we need to look very critically at our devices and match them very much to our patients. And for me, the respirator is a good device for that. So to conclude, I've looked at medications here. I've looked at some history of medications of COPD. I've looked at the problems with steroids. I've looked at the benefits of long-acting muscarinic antagonists. I've looked at putting the two drugs, long-acting muscarinic antagonists and long-acting beta agonists, together. I just want you to go away also thinking, remember the device. The device can be really important, because if you've got the best drug in the world and the patient cannot use the device, nothing happens. I want you to remember that one of the most effective and most cost-effective interventions in COPD ever is pulmonary rehabilitation, and that should be offered to all of our patients. We've got to get oxygen right. The most expensive drug in the UK is oxygen. and we're beginning to get it right. Body mass index is important. The biggest risk to the whole world is either people who are malnourished or people who are obese. And with our skinny patients, we need to get them fat, and with our fat patients, we need to get them skinny. I had a patient come into hospital. He's in hospital at the moment. His body mass index is 10.5 with COPD. He's the skinniest person I've ever seen. And we also need to focus a little bit on palliative care. Our patients do die of COPD and die sometimes in a difficult way. Dying with breathlessness is very hard to do. And COPD patients do not like to die at home. They feel they're a burden on their families, and sometimes we in hospitals need to do better with our provision of palliative care for those patients. Finally, I would like to stop and thank my main sponsors, clearly Boehringer, Pierre, and Lebanese Thoracic Society for inviting me here today, but my main sponsors, who are Philip and Morris, BAT, anyone else? Thank you.